All right, so if you don't have your notes, they're back there, so grab them. We got a lot of material to cover, and I'm going to try to get it all done this morning. If you'll notice, this says lesson four, and if you were paying close attention, last week was lesson five. And so that doesn't mean my arithmetic's bad. It just means that I had decided to change the order in which these lessons were done to make them, I thought, maybe a little more logical and building one on top of the other, and then I forgot to change the numbers at the top. So lesson five was last week. This is lesson four. And we're going to talk today about the will of God. So here's a question for you. When we think of God's will, and I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand. I just want you to answer this question in your mind. We think of God's will. Does God have a free will? Now think about the implications of that. Does God have a free will? We often think of humans in that respect. People talk all the time about, you know, do humans have free will? Well, I want you to ask yourself that question. Does God have free will? And if so, what does that mean for us? Well, we're going to answer that question today. So we're going to talk about several terms, then we're going to talk about the implications of these terms. Let's start here. God's will is both of necessity and free. Now, here's what I mean by that. In relationship to God's own nature, God wills certain things necessarily. Here's what Francis Turretin, famous French Reformed theologian, says. He is the ultimate end and the highest good, which he cannot but will in love. For he cannot nill his glory nor deny himself. So when you think of the question of why God does what God does, it starts there. God does what he does because he has a nature that delights in himself. And he cannot ever deny himself. You are called to deny yourself. Take up your cross and follow Jesus. But God cannot deny himself because what you're denying yourself of is what? Sinful nature. Your own inclinations. Desires that are warped by a nature that is turned inward. God's nature is perfect, as we've already seen. It's always good. It's never bad. And therefore, he can't deny himself because to deny himself would be denying the universe of the ultimate good. And yet, secondly, when it comes to his creation, God's will is free. Now, what do we mean by free? Because it's always a question of definition. What we mean is that it is not coerced. God's will is free in the sense that it is not coerced by anything outside of himself. So your prayers, do they change God? Do your prayers change God? Well, we've already established that God is immutable, right? God cannot be changed. God is impassionate. That is, he can't have his passions rise from anything that is outside of himself. Okay? So God cannot be changed by your prayers. Do your prayers change things? Yes. Because God, in his sovereign will, decrees that your prayers should be used as part of the process by which he is bringing all things into existence. And all things according to his will. So when we pray the Lord's Prayer, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. What's the third petition? Thy will be done. Now, is God sitting in heaven waiting to do his will if only enough people will ask him to do it? Well, I think you know the answer is, of course, no. Obviously not. So what's the purpose of praying? If he's going to do what he's going to do, then why do we pray? Well, the answer to that is, first of all, because he's commanded it. And that should be answer enough, right? God says, pray. You go, yes, sir. How far? How long? How high? You want us to pray? We'll pray. But also because God, who ordains the end results, also ordains all of the means to that end. And he brings us into this grand plan that he has to participate in it. And one of the great privileges that we have is to go and ask him in the name of Christ to do these things. And God uses our prayers as a means to accomplish what he has determined that he should do. So our prayers or anything else never coerce God. Okay, so of necessity, God can't deny himself, so he can only do what is true to his own nature. And then his will is free in the sense that he's not being coerced by anybody. Nobody's, you know, forcing God with his hand behind his back to do something that he doesn't want to do. Okay. Incidentally, we're not going to get into this today, but if we're talking about human freedom, it is exactly like that. You are free to act in accordance with your nature. You are not free to act in accordance with something that is not your nature. I don't want to get to heaven and have a free will. I want my nature to be so completely changed that I will never sin again. You don't want free will in heaven, do you? You want your nature to bind that will in righteousness. Well, that's what we mean by free will. A will that is free to choose in accordance with our nature. All right, we don't have time to talk about that today. Now, let's talk about this. We can also describe God's will as his decretive or his prescriptive will. Now, what in the world does it mean for God's will to be decretive? And what does it mean for it to be prescriptive? Well, some synonyms might help you understand this. God's decretive will is also called his secret will. Why is it called secret? You don't know it ahead of time. You can only know God's secret will in hindsight. Okay? There are people who believe that you can discover God's secret will through all kinds of mystical ways. I'm not one of those. The secret things belong to the Lord our God. They don't belong to you. God will do what God is going to do, and you don't have to worry about it. And you don't have to try to divine it ahead of time. God's prescriptive will is revealed. Okay? God's decretive will is sovereign. Ephesians 1:11. God wills all things that come to pass. God's prescriptive will is moral. God's decretive will directs all things. God's prescriptive will directs our conduct. Okay, so if his decretive will is secret, we'll talk more about this in a moment. If his decretive will is secret and it cannot be discovered, his prescriptive will is revealed. Where is it revealed? In the Word. In the Word. So probably, I don't know, more than most questions that I have ever been asked is, Pastor, how can I know God's will for my life? I get asked that a lot. And what they mean is that this is a 23-year-old who's trying to figure out who he should marry. And he doesn't want to make a mistake. I want to know God's will for my life. And so he's asking, can I know who God has sovereignly decreed that I should marry? And the answer is, I'll tell you, open your Bible. You should marry a woman, not a man, if you're a man. That's God's moral will. So if you're Adam, it's Eve, it's not Steve. Okay? That's God's moral will. So I should marry a woman. Yes, you should marry a woman. Well, there are a lot of them. Okay. God's moral will says she should be a believer. So we've just now cut the universe down by a lot, right? She should be a believer. But there's still a lot of believing women that are in the world. Okay, she can't be married. So you got to be single. Okay, well, it goes without saying. Well, it goes without saying, but there are a lot of people who, you know, are confused about that question. Right? If she belongs to somebody else, she doesn't belong to you. So let's put those boundaries. Okay. So she should be a believer. She should be a woman. Should be a Christian. That's still a lot of people out there. How can I know that I'm marrying exactly the right one? Well, who do you want to marry? You mean I get a choice in this? Well, yeah, you get a choice. God's given you his revealed will. This is what he says that you should do. Who do you want to marry? Well, I'd kind of like to marry so-and-so. Well, does she want to marry you? Well, I don't know. I haven't asked her yet. Well, you might want to have that conversation. You're getting the cart before the horse. Look, I can tell you for exactly who God has willed for you to marry without any question at all. Great. Tell me who that is. Well, we'll have to wait until 5 minutes after both of you have said I do. Because until that point, I might think that's God's sovereign will for you, but I can't know until she says I do and you say I do, and then we can know it. Here's the point. You can know the prescriptive will of God through the windshield. You can only know the decretive will of God in the rearview mirror. Don't confuse that. It's going to create all kinds of frustration for you if you're trying to divine the secret will of God ahead of time. Okay, I know that there are a lot of people who teach that it can be known. I'm just telling you they're wrong. Okay, let's talk about the decretive will, because here we get in some really sticky questions. The sovereign, secret, decretive will of God means that the Bible presents God as absolutely sovereign over the affairs of men. It is presenting God as king. Proverbs 16:9. A man's heart plans his way, but Yahweh directs his steps. Okay. What about sinful actions? Are the sinful actions of humans part of the sovereign will of God? Well, Joseph thought so. Look at Genesis 45:8. It's in your notes there. So his brothers have come to him. They're worried that dad's died. They are really concerned that Joseph is going to use his power now to exact revenge against them. And Joseph responds in Genesis 45:8. So now it was not you who sent me here. Time out, Joseph. We know the rest of the story. They put you in a pit. They were going to kill you. Reuben, was it Reuben who comes back and says, what are you doing? You can't kill him. He's our brother. And so they're taking him out of the well. And then some Midianite slave traders show up. And they sell Joseph to the Midianites. The Midianites then take him to Egypt, sell him to a guy by the name of Potiphar. So who sent him to Egypt? Joseph says, it wasn't you. Whew. Wow. Good. That alleviates them of any kind of responsibility in all this, right? Jenny says, no. Jenny is right. No, they're still morally culpable. Keep reading. It's God who sent me here, And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all of his house and a ruler throughout all of the land of Egypt. Now, I didn't put it here, but what does Joseph go on to say? You meant it for evil. God meant it for good. So, do the wicked, evil decisions that we make, are they part of the sovereign plan of God? According to Joseph, absolutely yes. Also, according to Peter. Look at Acts 4, 28, 26 through 28. Peter is praying. Here's what he says to the Lord. The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against Yahweh and against his Christ. For truly, against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, so all four groups, Herod, Pontius Pilate, Gentiles, people of Israel, were gathered together to do, and then what does that last phrase say? Let's read it together. Whatever your hand and your purpose determined before to be done. That's even hard to read, isn't it? It kind of gets stuck in our throats because we are so afraid that words like that make God the author of evil. And by the way, that's a really good fear to have. That's something we ought to be afraid of. We never, ever want to impugn the character of God so that the wicked hands of men become his authorship. Can't. And yet, Peter says here, right there in black and white, as clear as you can see, that Herod and Pontius Pilate and the people of Israel and the Gentiles all did what your hand had prepared. When did he decree it, according to that verse? What's the adverb? Before. You know why he's saying that? Because if he didn't, all of us would go, well, God is just the great chess master. He waits to see what moves we're going to make, and then he responds to it. He reacts to it. He's just really good at it. No, Peter says, they did what your hand had decreed beforehand they should do. No detail, including those that are seemingly minute and mundane, escape God's sovereign control. Proverbs 16:33. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. In a world ruled by a sovereign God, there is no thing called luck or chance. And that, by the way, should comfort you. Should comfort you. Remember the old poem? For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. And for want of a shoe, the horse is lost. And for want of a horse, the rider is lost. And for want of a rider, the battle is lost. And for want of a battle, the war is lost. All because a little nail fell out of a horseshoe. Oh, it's just terrible. Bad luck. You want to live in a world where your life is governed more by chance and luck and the decisions of others? Or do you want to live in a world where there is a personal, good, and righteous God who does all things well and decrees everything that should come to pass? Which world do you want to live in? I can tell you which world I want to live in. I don't want my life to be hanging in the balance depending on the decisions of other people or mere chance. Chance is a non-thing. It doesn't exist. It's a word that we use to describe mathematical probability. Behind that probability is a sovereign God. God sovereignly elects, draws, and preserves the people of his choosing. Isaiah 55:11. So shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void. It will accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it. Romans 9:15-16. For God says to Moses, I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So then, it is not of him who wills, nor of him who runs, but of God who shows mercy. James 1:18, of his own will he brought forth by the word of his truth that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Okay, that's his sovereign will. We'll talk more about it in a moment. Prescriptive will. What behavior does God prescribe? That's his will. It is his will that you should be gathered together with the saints of God this morning. And you have obeyed that will. And hence you are here. It is his sovereign will that all of you should be here. But there are some that cannot be here because according to his sovereign will, they're sick today. Or they're tending someone who is sick. Or they're recovering from their sickness. So if that's the case, are they breaking his revealed will? No, of course not. They're not sinning. Now, if instead of being here, they decided that they just didn't feel like it, they just didn't get around, there are other things that we could be doing today, we'll just not assemble with the people of God, that is also according to his secret will, but it is also sin. They violated his prescribed will for their life. Man is responsible to believe, and he's condemned if he doesn't. This is the revealed will of God. And even though, number two, God ordains the salvation of the elect, we are entrusted with the gospel and held responsible if we don't proclaim it. So again, it's kind of the same question that goes back to prayer. If God has a number of people that he has elected from all eternity, and they will be saved, then why do we preach the gospel? And the first answer is, because he commanded it. And that should be enough, but it isn't just enough. Because he has decreed that the proclamation of the gospel should be the means for which people are saved. I've given you some verses here. I'm moving pretty quickly because we've got to get to this third and fourth page. Now, over here, under the decretive will of God, by the way, some people pronounce this decretive. I just going to call it decretive. Under this decretive will of God, we have divine sovereignty. God does what he is going to do among the affairs of men. Okay? Under the prescriptive will of God, we have human responsibility. Now, this would seem to be the immovable object meeting the irresistible force. How can God be truly sovereign and man be truly responsible? Paul raises this question, by the way, in Romans chapter 9, because he's talking about God as sovereign. He says, God is like a potter, and he takes a clump of clay, and he begins to mold it and shape it. And some of these vessels that he shapes are for honor, and some of these vessels that he shapes are for dishonor. And he says, I know what you're thinking. You're asking this question, well, if that's how he made me, how am I at fault for what I've done? And Paul does not launch into a long discourse giving us a theodicy. What's a theodicy? It's an argument for God's righteousness. It's defending God's honor is what it is. He doesn't launch into that. You know what he says? Who are you, you little pipsqueak, to talk to God like that? That's why you should never say things like that. There is a mystery that is involved in this, and yet we can probe that mystery. So let's do it. So if you've been around here for any length of time at all, you know that I have often quoted D.A. Carson's definitions of biblical compatibilism. They're on page 3. It's right up at the beginning. By the way, this is a wonderful book called How Long, O Lord? It is a book on Christian suffering. Why, if God is good and he loves us, do Christians suffer? Why do we go through the things that we go through? This is a really wonderful treatise answering those questions. And one of the chapters that he has is defined is where he talks about biblical compatibilism. So let's read his definition, because these two definitions are really important. Keep in mind, we're talking about God's sovereignty and our moral responsibility here. Okay? So, number one, God is absolutely sovereign. But his sovereignty never functions in such a way that human responsibility is curtailed, minimized, or mitigated. There is a great difference between a robust biblical doctrine of God's sovereignty and an unbiblical worldly view of fatalism. Fatalism is impersonal. It's Doris Day singing, "Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be." How many of you are old enough to remember that song? So glad some of you know it. That's fatalism. It's impersonal. We believe in divine sovereignty. It's personal. God personally is taking interest in our life and directing it according to the way it should go. So again, God is absolutely sovereign, but his sovereignty never functions in such a way that human responsibility is curtailed, minimized, or mitigated. That's the first part of the definition. Here's the second. Human beings are morally responsible creatures. They significantly choose, rebel, obey, believe, defy, make decisions, and so forth. They are rightly held responsible for such actions, but this characteristic never functions so as to make God absolutely contingent. So boil this down. When God says to you, "You should pray to me," and you don't pray, you are making a decision. You can't say to God, "Well, I didn't pray because it wasn't your sovereign will that I should pray. If you had sovereignly willed that I should pray, I would have prayed. I'm not responsible for my lack of prayer." No, 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 no. You really are morally responsible people before God who are required to know his prescriptive will for your life. You are therefore morally responsible for your disobedience. On the other hand, when you do obey, your obedience is real. You've thought about it. You've pondered it. You've considered it. You've thought about obedience or disobedience, and you have chosen obedience. That means that you have obeyed him. You've really obeyed him. And this is a good thing. You're morally responsible human beings. So God is really, truly sovereign, but he's sovereign in a way that human responsibility is never curtailed, minimized, or mitigated. Human beings are morally responsible creatures, but that characteristic never functions to make God absolutely contingent. Remember, God's will is free. It is not coerced. So your actions cannot coerce God to change course from what he has decreed that it should happen. Now, how do you bring these two things together to make sense in a way that all of us can fully understand it? You can't. You can't. There's mystery here. But the Bible teaches both things, and therefore, as Christians, we don't have the option of editing the Bible. Let me show you an interesting test case for this. Go to the book of Acts, chapter 27. And we're going to have to hurry. Acts 27. So Paul is getting ready to sail for Rome. And sailing in first century is significantly more dangerous than sailing today. It can be dangerous today too, of course, but it's really dangerous in the first century, okay? So flip over. I should have looked at this ahead of time so I'd make sure I knew exactly the verses I wanted to point out. Okay, look at verse 9. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because of even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and of the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Okay, so here, Paul says, this is going to be a very difficult voyage. Get ready. Now, go all the way down to verse 21. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship, and he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have told you. But we must run aground on some island.'" Okay, now Paul can know the secret will of God because God, he is an apostle, and God appears before him and gives him this message, this vision, with an angel. That's not something you should expect. That's something that is unique in the first century. It is unique for the apostles in particular. It's a sign gift that's given to them. So that's what they have. Now, things get bad, okay? And verse 30 says, "And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers," look at this, "unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." Well, I thought he just said that God had told him in a dream nobody was going to be lost. Ship's going to be destroyed. But all their lives are going to be saved. Now he turns to them and he says, "Stay in the ship, and if you don't stay in the ship, you're going to perish." Well, now which is it, Paul? If God has sovereignly decreed that everybody should be saved and none of them should be lost, only the ship, then why are you telling them, stay in the ship? Because God's sovereignty always works in accordance with human responsibility. And this becomes an illustration of perseverance for us, doesn't it? God says, "I have chosen you from before the foundation of the world. I've set my love upon you. I have written you on my hand. You are my child. Nobody will pluck you from my hand. But if you don't persevere to the end, you will not be saved." Well, which is it? Did God eternally save me, or must I persevere to the end in order to be saved? The answer is yes. Both are true. One doesn't fight against the other. They work together. And the warning that Paul gives these men makes them stay in the ship, and what God had sovereignly decreed actually happens. So you have both of these things working hand in hand with one another. On sovereignty and freedom, letter B. God is qualitatively distinct from his creation. This allows each, God and his and humans, to act freely within the sphere of their existence. As Paul says in Acts 17, and I'm quoting here Mike Horton, as Paul's citation of the Greek poet affirms, we live and move and have our being in God, analogically, not with or alongside God, univocally. It is not shared space, but a lush garden of our own creaturely freedom that God has given to us. God's simplicity means that his will acts in perfect coordination with his being. Thus, he will never act as a divine despot unconditioned by his own nature. That's not who he is, and we've already said that his will is of necessity. But in the exercise of his will, God always acts as Father, Son, and Spirit, and through other contingent agencies. God's sovereignty, therefore, is personal and not some impersonal brute force. We're not Buddhist. We're Christians. We don't believe in impersonal force directing the world. We believe in a personal God who is directing it. And he directs it toward us as Father, Son, and Spirit. All right, divine will and human decisions. How do you make decisions if these things are true? Okay? If you ignore the prescriptive will of God and you just focus on the decretive will of God, it will paralyze you. You'll always be sitting around going, well, I don't know what I should do. I just wait and see what God's will is. Remember, you can't see his decretive will through the windshield. You can only see his decretive will in the rearview mirror. So if this is all you focus on, then you're never going to make any decisions because you can't know that will ahead of time. You aren't going to make decisions. Okay. So the pylons. The pylons believe that it is a good moral thing to take the gospel to Ireland. And they've said, here, my Lord, send me. They have reason to believe that it is God's sovereign will that they should get there. When will they know that their moral choice lines up with God's sovereign choice? When the plane lands and they walk off the plane and they hit the ground and they go, it was God's will. It was God's will. James 4:5. James is talking about making plans. And he's thinking about the businessmen in the church that are thinking about how they're going to go and expand their business. And the businessman says this, today or tomorrow I'm going to go into this city or that city, and I'm going to trade, and I'm going to buy, and I'm going to build my business. James says what to him? You're a fool. What you should say is what? If the Lord wills, I will tomorrow or the next day go into this city or that city and do such and such. Because you can't know this ahead of time. So you always condition your plans with that phrase, if the Lord wills. So stay in your lane. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. Since you cannot know the sovereign will of God, don't try to discern it. Instead, be humble enough to realize your plans may not come to pass. There's that verse I was thinking of, James 4:13-15. But you can know his revealed will, so give yourself to studying the Bible and make decisions based upon it. This is what he prescribes for you. He has revealed it to you. He is directing your conduct and making you a morally responsible human being. Focus your attention here so that you try to make decisions that will accord with his sovereign will, knowing that even the best laid plans of mice and men go awry. How does God's moral will affect this decision? Ask, what is right? Don't ask, what's God's will for my life? Ask, what's the right thing for me to do? You're asking about the prescriptive will of God, the revealed will of God. Are there consequences to the decision that might lead to a violation of God's revealed will for your life? If we've got any teenagers here, and I know we do, and you're thinking about your future, do I go to college? Do I just go straight into the workforce? Do I join the service? Things of that nature. Ask yourself, is there anything about what I really want to do that is a violation of God's revealed will? What he's told us in the Word. If your occupational aspirations are to be a mob hitman, I can tell you right now, that's not God's will for your life. Right? It's just not. Hope we don't have anybody in here who's thinking about that. Kind of doubt we do. Now, assuming that your decision passes this first test, ask this question. What is wise? What's wise? If it's right for me to do this, permitted for me to do this, then is it a wise thing for me to do? If you're 5'3", it probably is not wise to seek a career in the NBA. Unless your name is Muggsy Bogues, it's not going to happen for you. You're wasting your time. Stop it. If you have struggles in Algebra 1, you're not going to be a rocket scientist. I hate to tell you. So you can give yourself to it, and you can work hard at it, but it isn't happening. And when somebody tells you you can be everything you want to be, no, you can't. I'm here to tell you, I wish that were true. It's not. Okay? So ask yourself, what is wise? There may be more than one righteous option before you. You aren't sinning to choose either. But options are not usually equally wise. One choice may be better than the other, even though both are perfectly righteous choices. This is where if you grew up hearing that God's will, his sovereign will, is kind of like a bullseye, and you can aim your life at any part of the target. But what you want is to hit the center of God's will. Anybody taught that way? I was. You want to hit the center of God's will. So it might be God's second best for you or third best for you. I'm here to give you great news. God doesn't miss. And it's his will that is what's being aimed, and he doesn't miss the target. You will hit the bullseye. I assure you, you don't have to worry about that. Fourth question, what do you desire? What do you want? If your option meets the first criteria, these are good, righteous choices, and your options are both appear to be have wise benefits, then you're free to ask, what do I want to do? Then go after it, right? Jacob, where are you in your licensing? All right, so you did the commercial multi before you did the commercial single? Wow. Got your IFR rating yet? All right, so Jacob, if you didn't know this, is in flight school at Laterno, wants to be a pilot, just like good old mom, and he is on his path there. His older brother is as well. He's made decisions like this. He believes that it's right to be a pilot. There's nothing wrong with doing that. It's good. It's kind of a, you know, the family business, so, you know, maybe it's a wise thing. He's got lots of good counsel around him, people saying, yeah, Jacob, this is good, and so forth. How will he know that it is God's sovereign will for him? Well, when he signs that first contract, with that regional airline or whatever it is that he's going to end up doing. And he gets into their training program, and he doesn't get kicked out of it, and he eventually flies. He won't know ahead of time, so he's making these decisions. In essence, and I chose him here for this reason, in essence, all of us are flying by the instruments. And the instrument is this word. So focus on the instrument and trust the Lord to get you down safely. Okay, we're over. We got to stop. I know this raises lots of questions. I'll try to give some time in the Q&A coming up that we'll have in a couple of 3 weeks to talk about this in more detail. Thank you, everybody. Let's get ready to worship.